If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its fucking house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing, dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, we are inciting a New World Witchery riot. I know this is probably going to shock a lot of you all from from the title of the episode, but today's guest is Corey Hutchison, actually Dr. Corey Hutchison, gosh. He is the host of the podcast, the co-host of the podcast, New World Witchery, and of course the author of the new book out from Llewellyn, the new best-selling book, might I add. Before it's even come out, it's already hit the number one spot in the new releases category. New World Witchery, A Trove of North American Folk Magic, out April 8th. So if you're listening to this show the day that it comes out, two days from now, you can get this book. In fact, folks on social media are saying that their pre-orders of the book are already coming in. So if you order it, you might actually get it before the the book is technically officially released. It is an incredible, incredible book. I got to beta read the book or blurb the book or whatever. I got to read it several months ago. And I will be very honest here. I had to put off reading it for a couple of months, actually, because I was in the middle of writing my book, and I was, oh, y'all, when I tell you that Corey is one of those people that absolutely gives me imposter syndrome, I am not remotely kidding. but his book is a masterwork. He is who I want to be when I grow up. It is a very lengthy tome. It is going to be one of those books that 100% stands the test of time. It is 480 pages. It is over 2 pounds of a book, which is a hefty book. But it is one of those topics, one of those books, and one of those writers, which is just the perfect combination. Because, you know, we so rarely in the pagan community get someone with a legit, like, doctorate in the field in which they're writing. So it's such a pleasure and such a treat to see someone take such care to write on a subject, not only of which they're passionate about, but of which they have, like, years and years and years of experience and academic pursuit. So it's a treat, it's a treasure, which is probably why they called it A Trove of North American Folk Magic. So I highly recommend going out and getting a copy as soon as you possibly can. And if buying it isn't available to you, go get it from your local library. Please don't steal books. Real quick, before we get to the interview, I want to let you guys know a couple things. One, as always, Patreon supporters heard this episode first. If you like this show and would like to continue getting the show on time, supporting the show and helping me turn this into a more regular thing, possibly a weekly show, maybe a multimedia kind of thing, maybe there's some camera stuff, some YouTube stuff, I would love to grow the show and do more with the show. That just costs money. So here I am, hat in hand, asking you guys to sign up for my Patreon. You can do so at patreon.com/incitingprojects. I just beefed up all of the tiers and added some extra tiers as well. So let's go through those. And I'm going to go through them a little bit more in depth than I normally would. One, because it's my birthday month, so I figure I would take the time in the month of April to say, hey, now's a really good time to consider supporting Inciting a Riot if that's something you have been wanting to do as a birthday gift to me. Thank you in advance. But there are several tiers starting at $1 a month. You'll notice a couple things if you go to my Patreon. I used to have it set up that it was per creation. Mostly this was back from a time whenever the show wasn't always coming out on a monthly basis and certainly had never come out on a bi-monthly bi-weekly basis before. But I've been able to keep up with that pace for a year and a half now, so I feel like I've got a pretty good system going, so I can count on that. So you guys can count on that, so I'm not going to try to, like, fleece you guys. So we've ratcheted it back down to charging you just once a month, right at the beginning of the month. Tiers start at $1. For $1, you get early access to the full unedited audio interviews, so you get to hear my chats with my guests. Sometimes those are like 5 minutes, sometimes they're like 20, 30 minutes of additional content. So it's a lot that you get. Plus, for $1 a month, you get the invitation to the private Discord, which is where you, me, and the rest of the Rioter community can chat about episodes, about what's going on in the news, my favorite word of the day. So it's just a really fun time, and you get quite a lot of content and all of the back content for $1 a month. So if you join now, you get years and years worth of content for $1. It's a pretty good deal. If you feel like and are able to give a little bit more, at the $5 level, you get all of what I just said, plus you get full video content as well. I film all of my interviews via Zoom, so all of that video content is yours at the $5 level. You get to see the faces that I make. you get to see the faces that my guests and I make at each other. All the little notes, you get to see my office and my face and all of the other little things that you just can never see on a podcast. So you get that at the $5 level. There are new tiers. So if you have noticed in the last several months, the archived episodes of this show, basically everything from episode 1 to episode 98 and any like little special stuff in between, has all disappeared from the main feed. Why is that? Well, I've talked about it on previous shows, but if this is your first episode, it is because the show has changed drastically over the years. I have been doing this for about 12 years now, almost 12 years now. And in that time, the format of the show has changed. The quality of the show has changed. Who I am as a person has changed dramatically. And because of that, a lot of what the show is now bears very little resemblance to what the show used to be. So if you're tuning in for this particular podcast, how it is, how it's presented, what it does, what it's talking about, then all of those episodes are available for you on the public feed. However, if you want to hear my hot takes on news headlines from 9 years ago or 11 years ago, the show used to be a very topical show. It was always also truncated for several dozen episodes. It was scripted, and boy, howdy, I used to think that those scripts were good, and then we just did an Instagram Live where I kind of gave you a taste of what the monthly stuff is going to be on Patreon, and I went back and went through my very first episode, and I read through that script, and yikes, that was bad. It was so bad. It was so bad. But anyways, if you would like access to all of my archived episodes, I am uploading one a month. On the Patreon feed at the $10 level, you get to listen to my old archives. And this is, as soon as it's uploaded, it's always there. So it might not seem like a lot of content now, but it will be quite a lot of content very, very quickly. So at the $10 level, you get full access to my archived episodes, plus discussion about those archived episodes. Now, at the $15 level, you get all of that. Plus, you get an invitation to a monthly live Zoom chat with me and whoever my special guest is that month. I will have a special guest that month. I may not tell you until the day, but there will always be a special guest on that episode. You do not want to miss it. It will be very fun. Now, all of that being said, two more things. One, because it is my birthday month, and I am also trying very hard to get you guys to sign up for Patreon, I am doing a giveaway. If we, I am trying to get 35 new or upgrading members to my Patreon. So if you're already like a dollar a month member and you feel like upgrading to the $5 level or the $10 level or the $15 level to get all that additional content, now would be a really good month to do it, because this month, in order to try to get to the 35 new or upgrading subscribers, I am doing a giveaway. I'm giving away a copy of my book that doesn't come out until September 28th, and I'm still actually copy editing. So I'm giving away a book that isn't even finished yet, technically. So if you would like to get an advanced copy, an advanced reader copy of my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, out this September from Simon & Schuster, and you don't want to spend any money on it, on the book, but you do want to support the show, you could win a copy if you sign up for Patreon, if you upgrade your membership on Patreon, or if you don't want to do a monthly subscription this month only, if you do the little Ko-fi coffee tip jar, there's a little link in the notes for this show, you can get me a coffee. Apparently that's a thing, which is just like a one-time donation to the show. This month, if you do any one of those three things, buy the coffee, get a Patreon subscription, or upgrade your subscription, you are entered to win an advanced reader copy of this, of my book. Also, if we do hit my goal of 35 subscribers, I will invite everyone who donated via coffee or anyone who is a Patreon member to this month's chat. I am going to have special guests. You will want to be on that one. It will be fun. It will be my birthday month Patreon chat, and I will be drunk. So hot takes abound, and who knows if my shirt will be on. I will try very hard to keep it on, but I'm just letting you know, like, me and drinking, I will either take a nap or I will take my clothes off. So it's just, yeah. One last thing. If you would like to advertise on this show, I now have a way for you to do that. I didn't used to do advertising on the show, but the show is growing. And there is now more of a reason for, one, me to offer advertising, and two, for you to want to advertise on the show, because it is reaching more ears than ever before. So if you are interested in advertising on this show, spots are available. You can do so on patreon.com/incitingprojects. There is an advertising tier. It's $50 a spot. That gets you a 30-second ad here on this show. You can either send me a script, or you can send me your thing, your pagan pride, your new shop, your candles, your whatever. Whatever it is that you'd like to advertise, either you can send me your script, or you can tell me about it, and yeah, I'll vibe about it for 30 seconds, and we'll see what kind of ads I can come up with for you. If this is something that you would like to do, and you would like to advertise on Inciting a Riot, spots are $50 for a 30-second spot here on the show. I have four of them per month. Basically, the idea is that, you know, two of them would be on one show and two of them would be on another. I have had people ask me, well, how do I get the ad-free version of the show? Patreon is how you get the ad-free version of the show. It's, if you give me a dollar, I will give you an unedited show, which means there are no ads. So that's how that works. Anyways, thank you guys so much for paying attention. I know that that's just a lot of talk about me and money and me asking you for money, but it is my birthday month, so I thought it was an appropriate time to hold my hat out and say, hey, you've been listening to the show for a long time. There are several thousand of you. It'd be cool if maybe you thought about giving me a dollar. I mean, you know, you pay for Netflix, you pay for your Hulu, you pay for your, you know, whatever. Consider paying for your podcast. Anyways, that's going to be it for me. I will talk at the end of the show, of course. But now let's talk to Corey Hutchison. Corey Hutchison, welcome back. Welcome back. Thank you. To Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I'm so glad to have you back to celebrate the launch of your new book, New World Witchery. Congratulations, sir.
Couldn't come up with a better title. 10 years. 10 years. That's all I got.
You know, I was wondering, gosh, you know, that title, it feels like I've heard it somewhere before. Where'd you come up with New World Witchery?
Indeed. You know, what's really funny about that is, well, after I've, you know, submitted this, put this out, put it in marketing, everything like that, you know, I've been thinking more and more about it and how much, if I had to do it all over again, I probably would never have called our show that. you know, again, 10 years ago, what do we know? But just thinking about the fact that, like, there's this inherent kind of colonialism to calling it New World Witchery.
Yeah.
This colonialist mindset. But at the same time, I'm also like, but that's how people know this. And so all I can do right now is kind of own that and say, I recognize the problems with it. And so I tried to address this in the book. But yeah, it is interesting to see, like, it go from this nascent nugget of an idea for a podcast 10, 11 years ago. Now it's actually going to be literally a 2-pound book.
Oh my God.
You posted that thing about the book stake the other day, and I mentioned that to my wife, and she was like, you would die.
You would literally die
if you ate that.
But then I think about people like Morgan Daimler. Yes. Daimler. I always forget how to say their last name. And I think, you know, you might not have as large of a book steak, but you would be eating book steak a lot more often than me.
He would. I mean, I think they would have a book steak once a month.
I wish that I had that single-minded ability to just bang out like a 60,000 word book in like 4 days.
Remarkable.
So your book, New World Witchery, would you consider it an offshoot, a product, a byproduct of your podcast, or is that smoke and mirrors because it's the same name? And for folks, I don't know, maybe this is the first time they're ever tuning in and hearing you on my show. Walk us back. Who are you? Hi, who are
sure.
you?
Sure.
What's your show? Why are you here?
So I'm a middle-aged white guy, which means that you should listen to everything I say clearly, which, you know.
Wait, are we middle-aged? No.
No, you're not. I am. You're not. You're still young. You're still young and full of vigor.
As of yesterday, I was informed I was Gen Z, so I'm 24 again, baby.
Yeah, I am not. I run the cusp of Gen X and millennial, so sometimes they call us the Xennials, so. But anyway, so which has its own problems, but in the end, I'm also somebody who has spent a long time studying folklore. I've got obviously kind of degrees in that. You know, I also recognize all the problems that come along with a lot of that too. So at any rate, I've spent a long time studying folklore, particularly North American folklore, looking at folk magic. That's been the focus of our podcast for these past 10, 11 years.
Which you do with the Mysterious Lane.
With Mysterious Lane, who's just, it's just a voice modulation software that I use. She's wonderful. I couldn't ask for a better co-host or a better partner in magic. When she and I get together and practice, it's wonderful. So we've been doing that for a while. We've really wanted to look at what are the systems of folk magic that exist here on the North American continent? How are they applied? Which groups use them? How are they using them? And then really crucially, what can we do to bring those into our own lives for ourselves? And I find us kind of asking that question, saying, what can we do to do that thoughtfully? Because obviously there are real problems if you look around and you see all the North American folk magical systems, that some of them do not belong to everybody, right? And so you have to say, okay, well, what are the boundaries around those and what do we do with that? So that's been a lot of what we've done. The book, it is basically, it's me taking a look at the North American folk magical lore and saying, what would you need to do to figure out what your own system of folk magic is, the folk magic system that is already accessible within your life. And how do you unpack that? How do you recognize those pieces in your own life? I find 13, because I'm ridiculous like that, I find kind of 13 rites that I find sort of commonly distributed among a lot of the different folklore and say, okay, so initiation, there's usually some kind of initiatory process, right, that happens no matter what folk magic you're practicing, whether that is hoodoo, whether that is curanderismo, brujeria, echeria, any of these different practices, you're going to have some kind of an initiatory experience. Now, that doesn't mean that you get to go, or you or I get to go and say, okay, well, I like the curanderismo method, I'm going to go do that. Instead, what we need to do is say, okay, here are some of the commonalities within those systems. Let me look at my own community, the communities that I'm already a part of, and look for those same markers within my community and then elevate that into my system so that I can use that responsibly. And the thing that I've discovered, I'm sorry, I'm a little babbly with this, but the thing that I've discovered is when we started this show, we would always have people contacted us and said things like, I love hearing about all this stuff. I love hearing about this folk magic from all these traditions. I just wish I had that, or I just wish I had that in my life, you know? And inevitably I would always say, well, okay, you know, where are you from? What, you know, what do you have around you already? And you would find people, you could share little bits and pieces with them and say like, well, okay, do you have any rules about sweeping? Like, can you sweep under somebody's feet? And they say, oh no, sweep under their feet. That's bad luck. And you say, okay, that's a thing. You need to focus on that and dig into that, because that's some lore that taps into that magical system that you're already living in. For example, if you're in the South, that's, you're going to have some lore about that potentially. So, that's really what we're trying to do, is say, look, there is this folk magic. I haven't found a group of people yet who don't have folk magic within their community somewhere, but you have to do the work to go and figure out what that is and what that's like in your community. So that's really what this book is about.
So I'm a big fan of defining my terms, despite the fact that in my own book I dodged defining terms as much as humanly possible. But when you say folk magic, I think that people don't always know what that is or what that looks like. So what do you mean by folk magic?
That's a good question. I don't think I've actually been asked that yet. So well done you.
Thank you so much. I've interviewed a few people.
It shows. Good job. Good quality. So folk magic is, I mean, obviously I could be really reductive and just say magic of the folk. But let's, you know, break that open. So the folk are the community of people who share informal culture in common, right? Formal culture is this idea of the sort of official thing. So we have an official American culture that largely derives from our system of government, right? So we're a democratic republic, right? Or a democratic culture. We have that floats around, right? But then we have all these kind of informal things that make us American. And if you don't think we do, just ask somebody who's not from here about what an American is. You'll find real quick they have all kinds of ideas about what we are.
Or just give BuzzFeed 72 hours and they'll put out yet another article. Just put out another listicle about all the crazy things that Americans do.
Sure. You know, I love watching like those videos where like people from other countries try American foods or vice versa and things like that. Because you learn from people
watching. There's a video where you see like Hispanic people eating like Taco Bell for the first time.
Yeah.
And I just kind
of like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. It reminds my favorites me are of like family, but I digress.
I love it when people like when I think it's in that video that somebody like tries it and they're like, I don't know what this is. It tastes fine. I don't know what it is. Like, I always think that's really amusing.
Very much so. And I like that, but I also kind of like that because I feel like that's folk magic to an extent.
Yes,
like the Taco Bell taco is sometimes folk magic.
Well, you're right. So when we have mass culture as well, so you have mass culture, which is oftentimes kind of distributed through media or distributed through sort of corporate. It's not official in the same way that like the sort of governmental culture is official, and it's not completely informal either. But so let me put it. So a good way to think of informal culture is most people are going to have worked at a job, right? You're going to have a job that you've worked at. There are rules that go into working at that job. Some of them are in the handbook. That's your official culture. And some of them are, you know, if this person's working this day, they can cover you if you come in 5 minutes late, right? Some of them are, if you don't label your food, so-and-so is going to eat it, right? Jerry from accounting is going to come in and steal your leftover pork fried rice, right? You learn these through the experience of working with these people and having these conversations. And over time, everybody adapts to these rules and everybody adapts to these kind of informal cultural markers that are going on. That's the folk side of this. The magic side of this is oftentimes it kind of gets couched in superstition. I think that's an interesting word because most people deride that. But if you think about what superstition means, it's a sense of, you know, we all know what understanding means, but if you look at the root words for superstition, it basically means overstanding. And it's a sense of feeling like there's a unity, cohesion to things that are going on around you, that there are sort of principles governing your interactions with the world. And so if you combine that kind of mentality of the things I do have an impact, even if it's not a rational, clearly defined, empirically, scientifically driven impact, I do recognize that the things I do have an impact on my everyday life and maybe the everyday life of other people around me, through this kind of metaphorical language of the universe, right? And that your culture, your informal culture drives that. Those two things together essentially make folk magic.
You know, and one of the things that I think the chief thing that I like about your book and about your podcast and just sort of about your presence online, generally speaking, is that it gives an alternative to the fetishization of religious exoticism. One of the voices that I found when I was researching my book was Veronique Altglas. She is a lecturer in sociology at Queen's University Belfast, and she wrote a book about religious exoticism. It's From Yoga to Kabbalah, Religious Exoticism at the I really like the way that she sort of very plain spokenly, like non-judgmentally, but firmly, you know, talks about the fact that so much religious exoticism sort of comes from a bored Western culture. Mm-hmm. We look around at what we have and we don't think it's enough and we get kind of bored with it and we don't think there's a culture there. So we look to cultures that we think have a bright aesthetic, a bold aesthetic, a rich history, et cetera, et cetera. And we fetishize this religious exoticism. And we do that with a lot of things. And there's a lot of problematic stuff there. There's racial dynamics and class dynamics and all sorts of things wrapped up in that. But what I love, and when I read your book, I did a blurb for you and I said, you know, Corey sort of like turns you away from the ocean horizon and said, you know, stop looking out there and turn around and look at the mountains and the forests and the fields and stuff behind you. Look at what you have. There is magic here. There is tradition here. There's culture and community here. And you don't have to go elsewhere and look at it. You don't have to go mine someone else's culture. You know, you don't have to go 7,000 miles away to find culture and community and practice. It's here. It's here for you. And you built it. It already belongs to you. You already have claim to it.
Yeah.
What about that is important to you? Because obviously it's been the work you've done for, you know, your adult life.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right.
Thank you so much. And that does it for this episode.
That's it. Always and forever. But no, you're absolutely right that we tend to, and this is sort of the core in so many ways of New Age spirituality that happened, you know, from the, I was going to say from the 60s on, but I mean, that really had been happening since the 40s with the, you know, the way that people sort of exoticized Zen from, you know, the arrival of D.T. Suzuki and some of the other kind of people kind of the late 40s, early 50s. So this has been happening. And really, I mean, I say that, my brain's going backwards and backwards, like theosophy, right? Theosophy is the exoticization of, yep, of other cultures, right? And so this is just a thing that white people do, I guess. Is we look at these other cultures and we exoticize them and say, oh my gosh, they're so much more mystical than us. How do we get us some of that, right? And so then we'll just start like helping ourselves to the buffet of the world without realizing that, no, they didn't actually put the plate out there for us to take anything from, right? And it's in a lot of times, and you have, and am I allowed to use your metaphor from your book?
It's okay, on my show. I'm happy to promote myself anytime.
Because you have this amazing, you have this amazingly good metaphor of, and I'm totally going to butcher the metaphor at this point, but it's basically the idea of like, is it a window that you're looking through, right? Or is it a gate that's going to be open to you, right? And or do you say it as a gate or a doorway in your book?
A gate or a window, you're correct.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. And so this idea is that sometimes, you know, in a lot of cultures are very, very happy for you to see what they're doing. And they're very welcoming of, like, we would love for you to even maybe come participate a little bit as an observer or as the sort of, in this, you know, we see this at pride parades, right? Like, in a lot of pride parades, it's not that, you know, straight people or people who are not part of that community aren't welcome. They don't need to be on the float, right? They don't need to be marching down the center of the street, unless they're maybe part of the ally groups, but even then that's a little fuzzy, right? You know, sometimes it's there, you're there to support and observe from the sidelines, right? You're there to say, you know, I'm there to help uplift you, but I'm not part of this community. You know, this happened as well with Dia de Muertos celebrations in Austin particularly, but all throughout the Southwest, where Latinx communities or Latinx people in Latinx communities have been doing Dia de Muertos for years, for a very long time. And then white people saw it and were like, we really like that. We're going to start putting on La Catarina skulls and we're going to start putting on the calaveras.
Well, I like calaveras. That's so bright. It's that religious exoticism. Gosh, it's so bright. Our stuff is so dull. I'm like, you know, we have paint here.
Yes.
You can just make our stuff pretty.
Right. Yeah. And you don't have to copy their models of doing this. And then the worst part of it, I mean, to me, is that it went from being a Latinx founded and run, you know, parade that they might be doing to all of a sudden Latinx people have almost nothing to do with it. And mm-hmm. it's all white people that then have taken this over. And that's the exact opposite of what I want people doing in North America, because like you said, you can turn to our culture, and I say our culture, we have many cultures here. But you are a part of a culture, no matter where you are part of a culture that is going to have some good pieces of it, and that those good pieces potentially have folk magic in them, and all you have to do is know kind of where to poke and prod and look, and it's going to be there for you, and you can use it. And like you said, you can, you know, in the South we have Decoration Day, right? Mm-hmm. Where you go to the cemeteries and you put nice things on the on the gravestones, and you clean up the gravestones. Mm-hmm. You could do that mm-hmm. without stealing Dia de Muertos, right? You could totally do that. So just do that instead. or find the equivalent, find something that works in that same vein for you. And if it doesn't exist, whatever nuggets do exist, can you build something around that for yourself that isn't going to steal from somebody else? Which is something I think that you've done really, really well, even in your book, talking about this idea of, look, you can make this stuff up. That still works.
Oh my gosh. That's sort of something we were talking about a little bit in the pre-show, like thinking that because you've written a book or thinking that because you have a million something, like that you have been given, like, I don't know, access to a book at the end of the universe that's just the rules for all things and how things work. And I'm like, let me just tell you, as someone with a book deal, I made all of this up. All the spell shit at the back of the book, I made all that up. And you can also make it all up.
Yes.
Like there are basic fundamental sort of rules of how magic typically is believed mm-hmm. to work. They're very basic. And it doesn't take long to learn them and to master those very basic rules. And once you kind of learn them, you can play. And you can play in big ways.
Absolutely.
But what I like about your book is that, you know, I always, every time I started a new chapter, it felt like the camera reset and I got, you know, I saw the globe, and it was one of those like Google Earth zoom in things where it's like, I start from the globe and then I go down to a country and then I go down to like a state and then a county and then a farm. And then there's a guy sitting on a fence post, and then it zooms on like his hand. And suddenly I'm looking at like cellular stuff. But what I loved about your book is that it's like, okay, let's start here. Your culture is here. You're part of North America. Mm-hmm. Well, but you're also part of Appalachia, and you're also part of the, and then go, you know, deep, deep, deep dive down. And you talk about how, you know, you can look in your own backyard and revive practices or participate in practices that are existing. Yeah. What is something that surprised you? I mean, obviously, you know, you have a doctorate in American studies and emphasis in folklore, and you've been doing your podcast a long time. But I know just from researching my book that, like, there were points you probably thought you were going to make that while researching your book, you were like, oh, this surprised me. This is a new thing for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think what surprised me most in kind of putting this book together was how little I wanted to make this a collection of, like, correspondences, because it feels like when you read a lot of folklore books, right? A lot of books on folklore are essentially like, let me collect all of the things into a list for you, right? It's the BuzzFeed listicle of folklore. And I think that there's a real value to having those collections. I think those are really, really wonderful. But what I realized as I was kind of working through this was that if I tried to do that, I would never be done, because there's too much. Like, as it is, I think there's like 500 little folklore nuggets in there, right?
Yes.
And so I can't get super into depth with any one of them, or we're just going to get lost. So I have to kind of look for the ways that they weave together and have threads. And then two, the other side of this is that most of the time, as I'm kind of looking at this, what I really wind up doing is talking about these kind of thematic things that are happening around the folklore, and trying to create context, because that's the other problem that you get with folklore is you can get a whole collection of Appalachian folktales all day long. But if you don't have the context for what that is, you're going to have a very specific idea in your head about, oh, Appalachia, it's this and this and this and this. And I will tell you, if you try to tell somebody from Appalachia that Appalachia is this and this and this and this, and you're not from Appalachia, they're going to correct you real fast, because there's plenty of stereotypes. There's plenty of incorrect information that get lumped on any of the groups that are part of North America. And so you really need to have these contexts. One of the people I really have enjoyed reading their book of the past year is Jake Richards, who did Backwoods Witchcraft. Because what he does, he takes the entire almost first half of the book to be like, okay, you need to know some of the stories I grew up with before I can even talk about the witchcraft stuff, right? So here's a family story that I grew up with. Here's a piece of folklore from down the road from me. And I loved the way that he was like, you have to have context. And if you have the context, the folklore is so much richer and more meaningful. And so that's a lot of like what I'm hoping to do with pieces of this book, and then make people kind of seek out their own context as well. Yeah.
So I want to ask you about, so people might read your book, people might listen to your podcast and want to, you know, do what we do in our community and try to sort of educate themselves on folklore and folk magic and things like that. I want to ask, because you've been in both worlds. When you started your podcast, you were a person out in the world, and this was an interest of yours. It was a great interest of yours, but it was an interest of yours. Then fast forward a few years, and you got a formal education in a big fancy formal education in this particular field, and you are now very much an expert. But I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about, what can a lay person do to educate themselves without needing to go get a big fancy doctoral degree?
One, I'll tell you, you don't need a big fancy doctoral degree. It's funny because I do run into people who will claim the title of folklorist and don't have the doctoral or don't have the education to back it up. And I do get a little like, there's that tiny little gatekeeper in me that goes like, well, wait, what do you mean by you're a folklorist? Because there are people who will use that term to mean something like they like folklore and they're really into folklore, but then they're also doing some very exploitative things with folklore, and so I'm very cautious about somebody, you know, claiming that they're a folklorist and then, you know, basically saying like, I'm a folklorist and here's everything you need to know about African American culture, and I'm like, but you're not African American, and I see people do that, and that's a little touchy, But beyond that, you know, you don't need a degree in folklore to be interested in folklore and to find folklore in your own life and your own community. And that's something, there's a whole section, there's a whole exercise that I give people that I think one of the greatest things that I have been able to do in the past 10 years is have conversations with people, have the podcast where I interview people, have people who correspond with us, you know, sharing their family lore and talking to us about this. We have a Discord server and we have, you know, conversations with our listeners too. And I find like people want to share their stories and listening is so crucial. And so I like one of the things I have people do as one of the exercises in the book doesn't sound particularly witchy, but it's literally like go talk to people who are in your community, particularly maybe elders in your community, not elders in your witchcraft community, but literally like your grandparents, right? Or literally like, you know, spend some time, you know, actually go spend some time at a retirement home helping out around the place, right? Do some good in the world and start having conversations. Don't ask about magic because let me tell you, people are probably not going to volunteer that. But maybe ask them about, oh, well, you know, you said that your granddaughter got married. Well, what was that like? Oh, did she do the something borrowed something blue thing? Oh, no, she didn't. She did this instead. That's really interesting. Can you tell me? And I'm not saying like, you know, manipulate the conversation either. Have organic conversations. Have real conversations and be aware that there are these certain places you're going to find magical folklore. Holidays, weddings, deaths. There's going to be magical folklore around that stuff. But it's having these conversations and learning from the people in your community that's going to be your greatest boon. And you don't have to have a degree to do that. You just have to be a good person who wants to go and help other people and wants to talk to other people. That's it. And you can find out so much, so much about folk magic in your culture.
So I want to talk about a good friend of ours.
Oh, dear.
The devil.
Oh, boy, I've gotten that's the one I think I've gotten tagged on so far.
I know. And I want to ask you about it because I think I understood one because yeah. I've listened to your show for a very long time. So sure. I feel like I was at least indoctrinated into an understanding that so much of North American folklore is wrapped up in, I don't want to call it Christo-paganism, but just in this very heavily Christian influenced, you know, folklore.
Sure.
And the devil's a part of that. The yeah. devil is a figure that doesn't really show up in the Bible. There's no name for the devil as a name, as a proper name, isn't in the Bible at all.
Right.
It's a figment of Christian mystery from like, what, the last 500 years or so, 800 years?
Yeah.
And I researched a whole chapter that was cut out of my book because I was like, I'm not Corey. I can't write this chapter. But people seem to be quite surprised that the devil is in your book. Why the devil in your book, Corey?
Because the devil has a significant place in North American witch lore. That doesn't mean that the devil has to have a significant place in your particular version of witchcraft, but you can't ignore that the devil figure has shown up in virtually all versions of witch lore in North America. There's been some devil or devil-like figure. Now, This is not like Al-Shaitan, who is, you're thinking, like, we're talking about, like, who's named in the Bible. It's Al-Shaitan, right? It's Satan, so to speak, who's an adversary, sort of basically the prosecuting attorney in heaven, essentially, right? Not this, you know, he's not going around challenging people to fiddle contests, right? he's not showing up.
I don't know. I've seen Supernatural.
It's a different entity, though. He's not showing up at, you know, roadhouses in Texas asking young women to dance until they notice a cloven foot, right? This figure, this kind of tricky, slightly sinister, but not always evil, genuinely can be almost an educational figure, almost a teacher for some people in certain situations, or a challenge for them to overcome, right? Like most of the lore that you hear about the devil in folklore, the devil doesn't get the winning end of that deal. All right. The devil gets outsmarted. The devil gets tricked. The devil gets stuffed into a bag and beaten with a shovel, right? Like something happens. The poor devil. I mean, like after a certain point, I'm just like, man, I just give him a day off, please. He needs some hellish self-care. Please let him go, you know, go to a spa.
I feel like he would have a good face mask. Like I want that face mask. I would just peel
all charcoal and sulfur,
the old flesh off of my face. Just all of it.
Yeah, what if hell is really just self-care to the extreme?
It's like a really hot sauna, just like a really good, so you're just doing that like hot yoga,
right? But I mean, there's so much of that's just this, you know, this whole plethora of stuff. And I think it's funny, you're talking about like I converted you before we even had this conversation, so you're already sympathetic to the devil, which is great. And I'm sure that's going to do wonders for my reputation.
Well, okay, but so then somebody like me comes along and takes the person who's, you know, getting outraged because they see the word devil in a book that's published by a pagan publisher, and they're like, I went away from Christianity. I'm like, okay, stop. Let's think about two things here. Here's my sociology brain. Here's me thinking, okay, let's talk about big sociological concepts. So one, when you are doing your smoke cleansing, when you're doing your, you know, I'm waving my selenite in the air or whatever, what is it that you're doing? You're keeping negative energy. I'm using scare quotes here. You're keeping negative and bad spirits away. For a long time, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like reading some of these old stories, just sort of like the devil is just the bad spirits you're keeping at bay. Like, it's just another sort of big bad. It's just a generic bad that you're keeping away, in addition to being a specific person. Like, we have like, okay, I'm keeping negative energy, bad spirits away, but there's also like specific kinds of negative energy. There's specific kinds of ill spirit, you know, malefic spirits that we might recognize by a name or a type or something and want to keep those at bay. But also there's just generically bad spirit. There's just generically bad, and we're keeping that. So I'm like, so just take a step back. For quite a long time, just sort of the language that we used was the devil. We're keeping the devil away. Why? Because we existed in a time whenever the church ruled absolutely everything, and it doesn't quite rule as much now. It still rules a lot, but not quite as much now, not as much conversation. We have other kinds of language now. It's evolved a little bit, or at least broadened. And so we don't always use the devil. We don't blame the devil for everything anymore, all the time.
Sure. Some people certainly do. Sure. But no, and you're right. Like, the other side of this is that the devil doesn't always look the same. Like, this isn't, we're not always talking about the same devil, right? So people who were part of the sort of separatist, you know, New England of the 1600s, right? Oftentimes they wind up representing the devil as a couple of different things. Sometimes a man dressed all in black. Sometimes they'll represent them as a Native American figure. They'll have these kind of, but it's not the sort of like, you know, giant gnawing on people in a frozen block of ice that you see in Dante, right? Like, it's not that's not that Satan figure, right? Whereas then you go into parts of the South, you can have somebody who, again, man in black wearing a broad brimmed black hat. Or you might have this sort of well-dressed gentleman with a cloven foot, right? Something strange about their hand, perhaps. Whatever it is, like, these are distinct entities that we see kind of popping up, different versions of it, right? The Jersey Devil, right? Who I know we're not representing as the devil, but is this kind of monstrous figure, right? You have these other types of monsters that exist, you know, woodland lore, where you have, I was having a conversation the other day with somebody, we talked about all the different Bigfoots, right? And how some of these Bigfoots sound a little bit like the devils that people describe as kind of dark and hairy, right? And so these different figures pop up throughout lore, and they're a part of the backdrop that we have here. Again, doesn't mean you have to run out and embrace them and do stuff with them, but you have to accept that they are a part of the history and a part of the place. And it's not just the sense of like they were imposed by an official church, right? Because it's not it. Like the official church positions on a lot of these figures doesn't match up to the way people describe them in folklore. People are coming up with their own versions of these, or they're encountering whatever entities these are in whatever capacities they encounter them, and sharing those stories with other people. And the Christian framework is what they're sort of fitting it into. But that is kind of the history, particularly for European Americans. That's kind of the history that they're building on, right? And then later, you know, African American people as well kind of have a mythology that gets built into that too. Partially through the sort of slavery, sort of the horrible kind of legacy of slavery imposing Christianity on certain groups of slaves and certain groups of African Americans, and partly through their own lore that they were carrying forward and adapting into this new environment too. So, so you have all these different versions of the devil out there. It doesn't mean you have to say like, well, I guess I got to go worship the devil. That's ridiculous. Nobody's saying you have to do that.
And I don't think anything in your book says like worship the devil. It's more just like acknowledging that it's a figure in American folklore.
Yes.
That you're either keeping away or making a deal with, or, right. You know, it's just a part. And if you just massage the name and the idea, or you just sort of contextualize it a little bit, it's like, you're already doing all of these things.
Yes. Well, and so one of the things I have you do in the book, I'm glad that you brought that up, you know, massaging and sort of rethinking it. Like, if you had to say, like, who is your worst critic? Who brings out the worst in you? Who is
it? Oh, you're asking me.
Yeah.
Myself. I will say myself.
That's true. That's true for a lot of people, right? And so your devil is you, right? The devil is the devil inside of you, right? That's the one, that's your biggest antagonist that you have to get over. It's the one you have to face, right? And it's not easy. We both know that that's, as people with imposter syndrome, yes. It's not an easy challenge. So one of the things I have you do in the book is write your own contract with the devil. Who could be you? You can write your own contract with yourself. What are the criteria you're going to give yourself? What loopholes are you going to give yourself too? Because the devil always has loopholes, right? You know, you can do your own contract. And you're not signing your soul away to eternal damnation and torment. You're signing yourself over to yourself, but you're creating conditions and criteria that then you can live by, right? You're creating kind of an ethical code that is associated with kind of your magical side. So you can do that too, right? You can be your own devil if you need that. So
let's talk about some of the exercises in the book. It is not just a collection of folk magic that comes from folklore, from folk tale, but there's also exercises in there for your reader to get more familiar with the work, to find a way to start applying it. And it's by no means like an entire encyclopedia of all folk magic found in North America, it's basic. It's some basic stuff to get you started. Sure. Did you just make all that up?
Some of it very much, yes. There's a whole section where I talk about the idea of, we're getting into the idea of like holidays and festivals and stuff like that. And I say, well, you know, what if you, you know, made your pre-gaming, you know, your night out, what if you did that with magical intentions, right? So here's some drink recipes and how you might think of like, you know, what is a margarita going to do for you, magically speaking, right? So there's some of that I'm very much kind of riffing and sort of thinking through, just sort of as an exercise. And some of it is more rooted on folklore and tradition and stuff that I'm looking at specific traditions and specific ideas and examples, and then saying, okay, here's how I would adapt that within my own practice. So, and some of it's more of an adaptation than a total improvisation. And some of it is straight up, like you're saying, it's just made up, right? Which, as we've talked about, there's nothing wrong with that. All magic at some fundamental level was made up by somebody somewhere.
Yeah, by someone.
And nobody, I don't think I know a single person who every time they do magic does the spell exactly the way it's written in a book. So everybody's improvising.
I had to learn a long time. I don't always have the stuff on hand. And when you're very new, you think, oh gosh, I have to have all this stuff on hand.
Yeah.
But like, even like when I'm baking, like the very first thing I'll do is like, okay, so I made this cake for my husband yesterday. It was his birthday. And one of the ingredients is vanilla bean paste. Mm-hmm. There was no, I even looked at the fancy grocery store near me. They did not sell vanilla bean paste. So the first thing I do is like, can I just use vanilla? Can I just use vanilla extract? And the internet's like, yes. So, I mean, like, even inside of a system like baking, where things have to be very precise and very exact, or you will get mud. You will get very sweet mud instead of a souffle or whatever. There's still room for improvisation, for substitution, for personalization. And I think that, you know, once you've been in this game a little while, you realize, oh, there's a lot more room than I thought there was.
Yeah.
There's a lot more room. And that's what I appreciate about the exercises in your book, because it sort of introduces you to, you know, sort of a concept like I embrace, is just this idea of a canvas of like, make this yours. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And in the revised edition of your book that you sent forward, I don't know if you're letting people know that you're sending that out for people to look at or not, but
yes, that's
fine. Just ruined that. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
But yeah, you have this idea of like,
people know that that beta readers exist, I think.
I hope so. Yeah. But yeah, you had this idea of like the canvas, you know, the idea of the magical canvas and the tools with which you can sort of build on that to create the image that you want, right? The sort of final product. That's so much of what magic is. So much of magic is this, you know, you learn what works for you within your kind of cultural context. But then at that point, it's going to be up to you to decide how that applies. How does that play out within your actual practice, right? So, you know, if you grow up in, I keep coming back to the South because that's where I grew up, right? So you may have some associations with, you know, blue, paint blue on the ceiling of your porch, right? But that may be something where eventually that means nothing to you. So you're not going to go with that. But what does speak to you is maybe purple, right? There might be an association you have with purple that you find better for dealing with spirits in some way, shape, or form. And so you paint your porch roof purple. Now, that's not going to be within the context of the tradition that you're in. But you've at least thought through that process and said, well, this makes more sense to me, right? That this particular variation is going to make more sense the way that I practice my craft. And who knows, you may be the one who then sparks this whole like, all right, well, there was Haint Blue. Now there's Phantom Purple, right? Or Phantasm Purple or something like that. I feel like we're creating a Lowe's haunted paint section here. Do you want the Phantom Purple or do you want the Haint Blue? So
that's the only section in which I shop. Is the Lowe's haunted paint aisle?
Of course. Why would you shop anywhere else?
Absolutely. Sponsored by Lowe's. So I do want to ask because, and I know that this is a sensitive subject, and I might be opening a can of worms here that we don't have enough time to fully explore. But that's why you write a book, right? You have a casual conversation, and then there's a deeper conversation to have. But I think that I and some of the folks that I see have already read the book sort of have to wrestle a little bit with, the only word that's coming to mind right now is white guilt. Mm-hmm. But with the fact that so many practices, it's difficult, at least on the surface, to figure out whether or not something was a product of appropriation or a product of cultural exchange or a product of, this is just sort of a common theme in magic of people that are living below the poverty line, generally speaking. You go in and out of addressing that in your book. You talk a little bit about cultural appropriation and what is a gate and what's a window and what, you know, what people can take. How do you expect the reader, you know, how would you encourage a reader of your book to go about having that conversation with themselves? And then where do they go after reading your book?
I mean, that's a perfectly, I was going to say valid, but I mean, it's beyond valid. It's a very important question to be asking because, if you had a word you said there, the idea of like, what's okay to take. And I would say nothing is okay to take. There's no part of anybody else's culture that's okay to take. There's plenty that's okay to receive. That it's given as a gift. If you've had conversations with people from within a culture, or you're, you know, if you're reading, you know, a book written by somebody from that culture, and they've offered this to you in some way, then there may be an invitation in there for you to incorporate bits and pieces. But your invitation to do that is entirely dependent upon you listening to and respecting the wishes of those closed communities. Or even the communities that are open, but have some boundaries around that openness, right? So you have to be able to listen, and it's an ongoing process. You just rose up in the air, and it was really unsettling for a second. Sorry, those who were listening and not seeing this on camera, Firelight just literally levitated and hovered for a second because they came into their super Saiyan power.
Thank you.
but anyway, So having these ongoing conversations, it's never going to be over. You're never going to be done. People want a prepackaged one size fits all answer, and that doesn't work. It's never going to happen. I think your book gets into this quite a bit too, is this is not something that you can do a one and done. Okay, I've checked all the check boxes, so now I can do this practice. You may have a practice that you feel like you've been invited to do for years and years and years and years. And somebody's going to come from that community and say, I'm sorry, that's not okay. And you have to spend some time evaluating that, and say, maybe I have to put this aside, right?
Well, and there was the podcast Occultism with a Side of Salt just had Lilith Dorsey on.
Yeah.
We both love Lilith. And they talked about the idea of closed practices.
Yeah.
And, what exactly is a closed practice and what isn't a closed practice, et cetera, et cetera. And, they touched on a lot of the stuff that sort of we have both deep dived on, but it was really beautiful to hear Lilith speak about it directly. Of it's not necessarily that you can't be invited into a practice.
Right.
It's not necessarily that like either of us as cisgender white guys couldn't be invited into practicing hoodoo or curanderismo or mm-hmm. something like that, brujeria or cultures that belong to BIPOC individuals. It's more so about who then profits from those, because there's our community, and I don't know if it's a product of decentralization, I don't know if it's just the witch has always sort of been seen as that figure that's both a figure of spirit and also who you sought out to remedy things that you couldn't remedy in other ways. And there was also payment. There's also, there's a commerce there, trade-off. Sometimes it's money, sometimes it's goods, sometimes it's services. But, our community, our craft is so wrapped up in commerce. And Lilith talked a lot about the idea that just because you can be invited in doesn't necessarily mean you should turn around and then sell that culture back to others, or turn around at, Marika Clymer came on my show last year and we talked about Reiki, and, she talks about like, there are white folks that came into our community and learned, but then they adapted and then they created an entire system where they then profit from selling that culture back to, cultural carriers who lost touch because of colonization, because of immigration and things like that. And I think that's a really important conversation. And it's a good thing that you sort of talk about. It's not that you cannot learn about these other things. It's not even that you can't become a part of some of these other systems, mm-hmm. become a practitioner and be invited in and go through initiations and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's that then there's a responsibility there. You have to balance your privilege there, and you have to figure out whether or not it's appropriate for you then to then go and be the face of that community. You learned from amazing masters, you learned from amazing elders. Are you that person that should then turn around and go write the book and be invited on and have speaking mm-hmm. spots and et cetera, et cetera? And I can't answer that. You can't answer that, but it's certainly something that I feel like that community could maybe answer for you.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, that's something I think, I don't know about from your perspective in your book, but from my perspective in my book, I sit here and I worry about that quite a lot, because there are pieces of this where I sit there and go, look, I'm absolutely sharing a little piece of information from hoodoo, for example, right? Mm-hmm. I'm sharing a little piece of information from hoodoo. Now, I don't share anything that has ever been revealed to me in a sort of like closed environment. I'm very, very specific. I'm very careful about that. But some things that, are more publicly available or publicly disclosed, oftentimes as much as possible from people within that community, I may reference those pieces. I may talk about like, okay, well, here's, for example, mojos. Most people know what a mojo is if they know anything about hoodoo. So I'm going to mention mojos. I'm going to talk about mojos. But then I also want to situate this as this is a container type spell. And you need to then go look for the container type spell within your community. And if you're not a member of that community, you don't need to go around necessarily, saying that you make mojos and then particularly You don't need to go around selling mojos. You don't need to go around selling mojos to other people. And this is something, when Lane and I started, we had a little Etsy shop and we were making oils, some condition style oils, magical oils. And some of them are very effective. And I still have some oils that I make and I use that I think are very, very good oils. I don't sell them anymore because I very, very much, that was a mistake on our part. It was a mistake on my part to make those oils when there were people from the communities that we were adapting these from that were not receiving the benefit of that. That was wrong of us to do. And, you know, we've tried to, you know, make sure that we kind of direct people to those communities now as a way of sort of repaying the debt that we owe, you know, and, you know, spending money in those communities as well. But we had no right to do that. And so, and this is the other thing though, it's this too. You can be wrong and you can learn from it and you can grow.
Yes.
And you just have to accept it. You have to accept that sometimes you're going to have to say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. And yes. What can I do to make it better? And that is really, really hard for people to do. So hopefully people do that. I don't know.
Lilith actually gives a really good example, really good, very clear example of a time in which there was information that was shared. So Zora Neale Hurston, Lilith tells a story, and it's a much longer story, so I encourage you to go listen to that particular episode of Occultism with a Side of Salt. But she talks about the fact that, like, Zora Neale Hurston at one point found the recipe for a zombie and for how to make a zombie, and Hurston said, you know, I don't know that that's something that needs to be out in the world.
Yeah.
And so in Hurston's writing, that doesn't appear.
Right. She'll talk about the experience.
Wade Davis
came
along.
Yes. Yep. Wade Davis went down, found out about the pufferfish.
Right? It's like, oh, yep. I know about zombies. Yep. I'm going to write The Serpent and the Rainbow. And then that's going to become a movie. And then that's going to become sensationalized. And then the sensationalized version of hoodoo voodoo is, you know, with zombies and all of this like sensationalized religious exoticism stuff is going to become the conversation.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, I, there is just no more clear example. I mean, there's just a beautiful, brilliant example. And ooh, is it still, can I go back and revise my,
and what's really interesting,
revise my dang book.
And what I think is really interesting about that is that there are a lot of there's a lot of small steps along the way for that to reach the point that it did. Mm-hmm. So Neale Hurston was, you know, she was a Columbia University trained anthropologist who had learned from largely European American people about anthropology and then was encouraged to go into her own community and do anthropology. Now there's a positive side to that, but there's also a potentially exploitative side to that. And she recognized it and she tried to kind of resist it, but there's still criticism of her for doing some of what she did. Then you get to Wade Davis, who was not writing most of what he wrote with the intention that it would reach a huge audience. It was really academically oriented. It was written for people who had a very specific, narrow anthropological interest. And he wanted to sort of say, oh, well, there's this interesting kind of anthropological side to look at this. But in doing that, all of a sudden that book then gets picked up and moved into more of a mass media format. Gets picked up as a because The Serpent and the Rainbow, if you read it, it's not the movie.
No.
Like the movie out of it is totally not that.
Well, but I mean, Mean Girls isn't Queen Bees and Wannabes either.
Sure. Right. That's
a book it's a fictional narrative based on a nonfiction book about something that's only vaguely like what ends up being in the movie.
Yes. And that's what happens, right? Is that bit by bit the culture gets chipped away, right? Or the protective layer around the culture can get chipped away. And it's a problem, right? It's why we have to have the ongoing conversation. And I love that Lilith brought that up because that is such a good example of that.
And
happening.
That's how my brain works. How is Haitian voodoo like Mean Girls?
Yeah, I don't know that we want to dwell too much on that, quite frankly.
But... Nope. Glad I didn't write a whole book where I dedicated a chapter to Legally Blonde. So we are coming to the end of our time and I do want to respect your time. I have a question for you though, because I am a big fan of folklore. Mm-hmm. And you know, I want to learn everything about it. And I was really excited when it won Album of the Year at the Grammys this year. So I just, you know, as a person who considers themselves a folklorist, and by that I mean a huge devotee of Taylor Swift, mm-hmm. How did you feel about Swift's work on the album Folklore this past year?
I've literally listened to that album a couple dozen times. I've watched the Disney Plus special where she's doing the whole thing. The Bon Iver track is solid gold, and people need to listen to that because Bon Iver's voice alone is worth the price of admission. But that song is so good. And I realized, like, anybody who took me seriously as a folklorist right now is like, nope, out, see ya. But it is a good album. It is really funny because Folklore Twitter, like the academic folklorists on Twitter, lost their damn minds over this because what she did was she got a trademark.
Yeah.
Or not a trademark, a
she
little
got
mark.
A little that, Twitter hashtag or whatever that whatever Twitter does that specifically like puts a little picture next to their hashtags.
Yeah, and so it was hashtag.
This is why I'm asking you about this because folklore Twitter has this thing on like Folklore Thursday where we talk about folklore from around the world on Thursdays,
which
she happened to release her album
on a Thursday on Folklore
on a Thursday.
Yeah, it went nuts. And I will say actually, Folklore Thursday. I love Folklore Thursday, and I love the people who are involved with that. Dee Dee Cheney and some of the other folks who are involved are really, really wonderful folklorists. It does get there's some really interesting things that happen with that where people will share stuff that is not. Actually rooted in folklore. Morgan Dimler's done a really good job of being like, whoa, 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 that comes out of urban fantasy. That comes out of RPGs and stuff like that. But there's not really a way to monitor what gets hashtagged Folklore Thursday. So I'll just say, don't take everything that's hashtagged Folklore Thursday as definitive of folklore.
I think as both of us always say, use it as a springboard for further research.
Exactly.
As Kathleen might say, please use this episode as a springboard for further research.
Indeed. But yeah, no, when Taylor Swift's album came out, it was, folklore, academic folklore. Like, what was one of my favorite responses was people then took Taylor Swift album covers and promotional shots and turned them into folkloric memes.
Yes.
So it was kind of like, it was their sort of like, subtle biting back at Taylor Swift for this, but realistically, like, there was just you're not going to be able to resist. Academia is never going to be able to resist that kind of pop cultural flood, so I say roll with it. It was funny because this, you know, this also happened with Aaron Mankey with the Lore podcast, and I'm a little critical of the Lore podcast because it situates itself as a folklore podcast, and Mankey kind of situates himself as a folklorist and folklore historian in some cases. And I think he's really good. And sometimes he's kind of drifting off into some spaces that he shouldn't drift off into. And so he got kind of called on the carpet, but I will say to his credit, he was very respectful and he listened to people saying like, look, you need to think about this.
The power of just saying, oh, you know what? Gosh, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
Thank you. I will grow now.
Yeah, and he's done a pretty good job with that. I know lots of people who love lore, and I wouldn't turn to it as like my primary source for a lot of folklore, but it's a good jumping off point. It's perfectly reasonable to start there. So, yeah, and he's good about listening. And hopefully, all of us can be better about listening. If nothing else, I think both of our books are asking people to be better about listening. So.
Well, Corey Hutchison, I want to thank you so much for being here on Inciting a Riot. When this show airs, there will still be time for them to pre-order your book because it will come out 2 days after this episode. So if you're listening to this on the day that it airs, your book comes out in 2 days.
Yay!
Unless of course the glue doesn't dry or something.
Of course, yes.
You know, it's a very big book and that's a lot of glue.
Yeah. Well, and 3 days later, I'll be dead because I'll have eaten a 2-pound book steak. So.
I wish you the greatest of luck on your book stake. For folks that want to get a little bit more of you, where can we get more Corey Hutchison?
I have no idea why they would want to, but you can find more about me at newworldwitchery.com. It's kind of the main place to go. We have social media accounts on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, technically on TikTok. I'm still working with that
I'm
a little
so
bit.
I'm so glad that you've joined me in my madness there.
I don't know if you know. Did you know that Lane joined Instagram?
What? Yes. Yeah. No, I follow her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a whole new world for me. I was like, Lane is on the social media with me. This is so
Lane,
great.
Lane is 3 months away from a thirst trap. I can't wait. I'm like, there's going to be... There is a face reveal that is like 12 years in the making.
Oh, no.
At this point, I'm just like, I don't know who I have built Lane up, because I missed the one supermoot that she went to.
She was.
And I was just like, I could have met Lane. And at this point, I don't even know that I want to see what she looks like, because I'm just like, I have built Lane up in my head. I don't know what she actually looks like, but I'm just like, she is the witchiest of all witches in my head. Like, there's a lot of shawls happening, like necklaces. There's like, leather bracelets with really creepy charms on it. Just like, just like, that's Lane.
I mean, I'm not going to reveal anything other than to say, like, if you are in her presence, you feel the magic. She exudes a warmth and delight. So I encourage people to follow her, too. So.
Well, Corey Hutchison, thanks so much for coming back to Inciting a Riot.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
It's always fun having you on. Apparently, it's an annual tradition at this point. Congratulations on the new book. It gave me, I had to wait until I was mostly done with my first draft of my book to read it, because I knew it was going to give me imposter syndrome. And then I read it and it did. So I'm mad at you. It is so incredibly brilliant. I encourage all of you to go and read it. Go get New World Witchery as soon as you possibly can. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, rioters, that is going to do it here for us today on Inciting a New World Witchery Riot. Once again, I'd like to thank my friend, fellow podcast host, and fellow author, Corey Hutchison, for being my guest today. I highly encourage you all to go check out his podcast, get his book, support whatever it is that he's doing, because whatever it is that he's doing is probably awesome. links to everything Corey and all things New World Witchery will be on the show notes on my blog at incitingariot.com. A couple quick things here at the end of the show. If you like this show and you'd like to support it, there are a number of ways that you can help. Lots of free ways that you can help, like liking and sharing it on social media. You can also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and leave a review. The more of you guys that are like, hey, I'm going to take 30 seconds and say, I really like the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you review shows, the more that the great and mighty algorithm thinks that this show is worth a damn and bumps it up in the feeds so that other people can find it when they're searching for pagan podcasts, social commentary, etc., etc. You can also continue to help me produce the show by becoming a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/incitingprojects. I'm not going to repeat everything I said at the beginning of the show, but just to remind you guys, there is a lot of content. I am producing a lot more for you as well. To try to get you guys to understand that you're getting something for your money. I don't want you to think that, like, you give me a dollar and then I just take that dollar and run to Starbucks. it is actually being reinvested back into the show. So every dollar helps. And I thank you guys so much for supporting the show and for continuing to support me and the projects that I undertake. So you can do that at patreon.com/incitingprojects. Lots of tiers that you could possibly join. The other thing that you can do, if signing up for a monthly subscription just isn't your thing, or if you just want to say happy birthday, you can buy me a coffee. You can do that at ko-fi.com/incitingariot. Again, those links are going to be in the show note, but that is just a one-time donation to the show, one and done. And remember that this month we are trying to get 35 new or upgrading Patreon subscribers. So there are prizes this month, April 2021, if you would like to donate to the show in some kind of way or upgrade your existing membership, you get entered to win a copy of my book. You can also, I'm going to be this guy, but you can pre-order my book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft, anywhere books are sold. It comes out September of this year from Simon & Schuster. I'm going to stop talking now. Oh, social media. Sorry. You can find me at Inciting a Riot on Instagram, Twitter. You can find the show's Facebook page, Inciting a Riot Podcast. I'm on TikTok. That's the thing. I can't believe it. So old. But pretty much whatever form of social media you're using, look up Inciting a Riot, and either you're going to get on an FBI list or you're going to get me. That is going to do it here for us today on Inciting a Riot. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks for downloading the show, and thanks for telling other people about the show. I am starting to get more and more of you guys tagging me in these cute little posts about, like, you know, your favorite podcasts, favorite podcasters. That really does mean a lot. You know, it lets me know that people are listening. And when you're making these shows and you're doing this sort of from the privacy of your home, recording in a closet, it's sometimes hard to remember that there are actual real human beings listening with their ear holes to what I say. So that's pretty cool. Anyways, I'm going to leave you. But as always, I will leave you with love and light, firelight.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.